Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Hello, and welcome to CFRI's CF Community Voices, coming to you from our home studio in Palo Alto, California. I'm Sue Landgraf, Executive Director of Cystic Fibrosis Research Incorporated, CFRI, and I'm very pleased to welcome our viewers and listeners. We have a very special program ahead, but before getting started, I want to thank our generous sponsors, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, Chiesa USA, Gilead Sciences, Genentech, and Proteostasis Therapeutics. I also would like to note that no information presented in this podcast is intended for a patient's diagnosis or treatment. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thank you, and let's get started.
All right, thank you, Siri. And thanks for having me. This is us. My wife has cystic fibrosis. She was diagnosed at 6 months old. And that's me. I'm the guy on the left. I titled my book, Lessons from a CF Corner Man. And I thought I was really clever when I did it. But then I found that I was explaining that title to everybody who heard about the book. Everybody here knows what CF is. Personally, I grew up in a family that did martial arts. I taught Taekwondo, we owned a school, I cross-trained, and in the way I grew up, corner man had a special meaning. You weren't fighting the fight, but you were on the side. You had to know the person that was fighting, know how to support them, know their strengths and their weaknesses, and how to motivate them. So when Rebecca went into respiratory failure, that was kind of how I pictured myself. And because my title's not so intuitive, I had a nice long subtitle called 38 Lessons I Learned During My Wife's Illness and Lung Transplant. And I've got a lot of these lessons dispersed throughout the different slides, and they were just in context, they show kind of how I learned these lessons and really what they meant to me and how they helped me get through that situation. So that's my wife, and those are her cats. There's only two cats there, but there's a lot of pictures of her with her cats. And in 2014, Rebecca was on 24/7 supplemental oxygen. And she would have the concentrator in one part of the house, and she had a long tube to her cannula. And when she walked around, she called it her leash, she would play with her cats sometimes. And the cats would chase the tubing, and Rebecca would play with her cats and pick them up. Then we went on vacation, and she noticed that the concentrator that we rented was a little bit more powerful than the concentrator we had at home. And we got home, and I was checking out the concentrator, trying to figure out what went wrong with it, and looked at the tubing, and there were dozens of little bites from all the cats just chewing through the tubing and biting the tubing. And to me, it was just a good example of when you deal with CF, there's all sorts of things that come to you from different directions that you have to deal with. And that taught us to change our tubing a little bit more frequently and also to chase the cats away from the tubing whenever they got near it. So I met Rebecca in college. We were both 20. It was about 20 years ago. And when I met her, she was very impressive. She was a cytogenetics and molecular biology major. She had a lot of scholarships, and like even growing up, even her history was impressive. She was a just one of those persons that was very driven. When she was 10, her mother moved away, and then when she was 18, she was basically on her own. She paid for her way through college, and she handled all of this stuff while having CF and CF-related diabetes. And it just really made her seem very impressive to me when I met her. And when I met her, I didn't know what cystic fibrosis was. So when she asked me if I knew what it was, obviously I said, yes, of course. You know, I've heard the words, but you know, I kind of know what it is. And she didn't really believe me, so she gave me an 8-page technical document to go and read through with what was happening on a molecular level and a clinical level, and I read through that. And of course it was challenging, because as we started to grow closer, you know, it was something that, you know, I worried about. You know, at the time the life expectancy was around 30, and I imagined us, you know, getting closer, and you know, obviously I worried about, you know, being middle-aged and being on my own, you know, just, you know, having to deal with this loss. And if you put aside the fact that I thought middle-aged was 30, I've since adjusted that perspective. It was really because, you know, it was really down to fear. And I realized I was afraid because I loved her and I didn't want to lose her. And ultimately I learned that nobody knows what life will bring. And I decided not to let fear of loss dictate my life. And that was one of the early lessons I learned in our relationship, was that sometimes you have to trust your instincts and not focus on the worst that could happen. And you also have to adapt. So when we were in college, Rebecca ended up with pneumonia and she was on IV antibiotics. And as the disease, being a progressive disease, over the years it got a little bit worse. She would go in for tune-ups, and it was once a year, then it was twice a year, then she ended up on oxygen. Then, and that was oxygen just when she slept and exercised. And then in 2014, her condition took a sharp decline, and she was in the hospital for 6 tune-ups versus 2 the prior year. And on Christmas, we went home, and she was on 24/7 oxygen by that point. And 9 days later, New Year's Eve hit, and she was intubated on New Year's Eve with respiratory failure. So when New Year's Eve morning came around, Rebecca was already in a hospital. She was in there for a tune-up. She'd been in there for a couple of days, and I was planning on going in and we'd celebrate New Year's. And I got a call from her phone, but on the other end of the line, it was a doctor. And obviously that's a little startling. And he said these words that I wasn't as familiar with. He was saying BiPAP and are you coming down to the MICU? And I remember feeling like I would have been more prepared for that moment, but we always thought it was going to be a little further off. And I ran upstairs to get changed and came back down for my charger and back up for my iPad. And then at some point I looked down and I was still in my boxers, and I was like, I'm not getting any closer to getting out of the door. And I recognized that really all I needed to do was show up. I didn't need to do anything amazing. I didn't need to perform surgery. I didn't need to know anything. I just needed to physically show up. And when I got there, shortly after they intubated her, they put her in a chemically induced coma, and she was struggling a little bit. She would wake up a little bit here and there, and she woke up and she signaled to me like this. I was like, what is that? I'm like, do you want me to take your picture? And she shook her head, yeah. And I didn't want to take her picture, but then I took her picture and she gave me this double thumbs up. So I took a picture of the double thumbs up. And what that meant to me was I wasn't taking a picture of her in a tough situation for the nature of being in a tough situation for that reason, but because she was going to recover and she wanted to see what happened to her. So I had to look at it from the perspective of she was going to recover, and that was the reason I was going to document and take a couple of pictures of what was going on. And I sat by her bed and held her hand, and obviously you want to wish away everything that's happening. You want to wish that, you know, we weren't in the current situation. But you also recognize that in order to not be in the current situation, we wouldn't have had our past together. And that was something that I wasn't willing to give up. So I found it was more helpful for me to focus on being thankful for the time that we had together rather than worrying about what the current situation was and what it meant. And I actually found that was actually more helpful to me. So advocating was something that I learned really had a lot of value, because I started out and I would sleep in the corner of the hospital room. I had this great little recliner that would recline when you pushed it back, and then when you relaxed, it would bring you back up. And, you know, we had the little plastic gowns, and I would sit in the corner of the room, and then I recognized she's got good care here. We chose this hospital for a reason. And eventually, I learned to, I've got to go home, I can sleep at home, I'll stay here if I need to. But sitting in that hospital room, I also recognized the more important things. She had the doctors had rounds every morning at 8 a.m. They included me in and on the rounds. I could ask my questions, I can give my feedback. The nurses spent a lot of time with her in the ICU, but not as much time as I spent because I was pretty much in the room all day. And because of that, I felt like I added value to the conversation. And knowing that I added that value really made me understand that that I had a reason to be there. And ultimately, I ended up leaving my job at the time because I wanted to be there and be able to advocate for Rebecca as she got through that situation. And again, she was in a chemically induced coma, and it was a lot to look at. You know, she was there, she was sleeping, and you look around the room and you've got machines and readouts and alarms going off. So as we started to get family out, you know, I felt like I started to adjust to the situation pretty well. Then as we started to get family out, I would try to prep them as we went to the hospital. Okay, all right, don't worry about this. That one's gonna alarm, don't worry about that. Look at the oxygen saturation level, you know, and you can get them to come in and they can suction her and she'll cough and they'll be able to remove some of the secretions. So, you know, I was able to deal with that, and as family visited, most of the visits started to go well. Eventually we ended up coming into some challenges. Her mother planned a visit out, and we ended up finding out that she was sick and she had a respiratory illness. And essentially, I had to call her and say, you can't come out. You're gonna have to delay your trip. You know, it was simple rhinovirus that put Rebecca into the hospital to begin with. So you're gonna have to delay your trip. And I think some of that might've been due to the fact that she had left when Rebecca was 10 and Rebecca was relatively healthy when she was young. And then even on a more recent trip when she'd come out, she had commented that she thought Rebecca was playing up her illness to try to get sympathy from me. And you know, I think in a sense it was, she didn't want to believe Rebecca was as sick as she was. So eventually she did come out, and she had done a couple of Google searches at the time. So she came out, and she was convinced that the hospitals were sedating her unnecessarily, and that Rebecca would be fine if they just stopped sedating her. Initially, of course, you're working with the doctors and you understand what's going on. So I tried to explain to her, and I felt like it was my job to convince her that, no, that's not the case. These are the reasons why her care changed. These are the reasons why she's on the medication that she's on. But there wasn't really much convincing her. And as she, you know, as she progressed with that idea, I learned that I don't want to, she wanted me to ask the doctors these questions and push back on the doctors, like, you know, like maybe they were not doing the right things for other reasons. And ultimately, I question the doctors on their treatment all the time. Like, I ask a lot of questions, I offer alternatives, I come up with as many ideas as I can, even if I don't know what I'm talking about. But I never question their motives. And this was something that I wasn't ready to do and I didn't want to do. So ultimately what I told her was, if you have this question, you should definitely ask when the doctors come in. And that was a way to not put that on my own shoulders. It was to say, you know what, I'm not going to worry about what you're worrying about. It's okay if you ask, please ask. And ultimately she never did ask, and maybe it was because she saw the care that Rebecca was getting. Maybe it was for another reason. But there was some value in not taking that on to myself and saying, yeah, you can ask that question if you need to. And advocating never ends, but fortunately it changed because Rebecca woke up. She got out of the ICU, she was moved to a long-term acute care center across town, and she woke up. When Rebecca woke up, she had a lot of muscle atrophy. They tell you 7% a day, and she was sedated for about 6 weeks. So it was really tough. She woke up and she physically couldn't reach up to scratch her cheek. I would sit by her bed, and when I'd see her hand start to tremble, I'd go over and I'd try to see if I could scratch the right spot. And she was just very weak. But we started to work, and that was our goal, because we knew that if she got stronger and she could potentially qualify for a transplant, because her doctor told her that the only person that she saw transplanted on a ventilator was up and walking and stronger. So that was our goal, to get stronger. At the same time, Rebecca was still on the ventilator. She had a trach in, so the air moves in and out underneath your vocal cords, so you can't speak when you've got a trach. So a lot of her caregivers would come in, and not intentionally, but sometimes would kind of ignore her a little bit. They'd go about their business, trying to get her medications ready, do whatever. And it was my job to chime in and say, hey, you know, Rebecca has a question. Rebecca wants to do this. And I had to learn how to read her lips, which was virtually impossible because she speaks faster than even I do sometimes. And she would, so that was my job. But sometimes we would get a new doctor or a new caregiver that would come in. And they would see how weak she was, and they'd say, Rebecca, you really gotta get up. You gotta start walking. You gotta do this. And she was doing so much. We exercised. I pushed and pulled with her into bed on top of her doing squats and physical therapy and going out for walks as she got stronger. So that gave her an opportunity to point to her dry erase board and be like, no, I'm doing that. Even though she didn't have a voice, it kind of gave her a little bit of an additional voice. Then in the bottom right, I did an Excel spreadsheet as we started to think maybe it's an option to get a transplant. They told us that maybe not because she was so sick, but they never said definitely. So I started pulling the spreadsheet together. It was all the hospitals that were covered by insurance in network, and then got information from UNOS, a website that an organization that oversees transplants and provides a lot of statistics. 1 year survival rate, 5 year survival rate. I went to the websites. I was trying to find good locations that would work with us. I mean, it was a great spreadsheet from an engineer. Like, it was awesome. Like, it was a great spreadsheet. And one of the cool things about writing a book is I actually have a chapter in the book where I call it the spreadsheet champion, and I just name myself the spreadsheet champion because I can. Like, who's gonna stop me? So I did this spreadsheet. And you know, and it was a way to prioritize where we would apply. So previously our doctor had said, you know, plan for the worst, but hope for the best. And I modified that a little bit to plan for the worst, plan for the best, and plan for everything in between. And it was just a way to be, you understand that the worst can happen, but also being able to try to figure out, hey, where can we apply? What can we do next? What's the best course? Thinking along those lines also was important for us. And smiling was pretty important. When Rebecca first woke up, she couldn't stand up under her own strength. And obviously I'm there as a spouse looking at her worried, thinking all these things, and they decide, okay, her physical therapy is to get in a wheelchair. So she can't stand up, so they use this Hoyer lift, and they lift her up, and I'm looking at them moving all these lines and ventilators, and I'm worried, and I'm thinking. And then I look over her, and she's grinning ear to ear. They lifted her up. She's like, that was so much fun. Like, now, if you talk to her, she's like, that was so much fun. They put her in the chair, and she started shooting with her fingers, and she's saying something. We're trying to read her lips. I'm looking, and she's... I'm like, what? She said, I'm a badass. And that's what she was saying as she was shooting her little finger gun. I'm a badass. So I tried to get a picture of that too. And a lot of it was just recognizing that, yeah, it wasn't necessarily a good day, but it was good to have that day. You have to appreciate the time that you've got. And having an extra day was just a chance to be there together and create a new memory. Also, we had to understand that hospital food is terrible. So I bought her a large quantity of Frosties from Wendy's. That was one of her favorites. We had an entire cabinet in the room that was just dedicated to food. I would bring in snacks, and I had a little cooler that I'd bring in every day. And it was just important to make those things that make you happy part of your routine. So Paul, our cat, was one of those things that was part of our routine. I tried to bring in Priscilla, but Priscilla just climbed underneath one of the shelving units and I just crawl after her trying to pull her out. It wasn't great. It wasn't really that helpful. But Paul would actually sit on her lap, and when she was having a tough day, I'd go home, I'd get Paul, and I'd put Paul on her lap, and it would always bring a smile. And it was just making those things that make you happy part of your routine. Laughing. Again, Rebecca being comfortable in the hospital room, whether it's food or just physically being comfortable, meant a lot. I bought her this mask, and it had like a cooling insert for when she had headaches. And then we eventually got her like a nice neck pillow, and she always had like five pillows around her, like on the back and under the arms, and they were all strategically placed. And in the upper right, you could see she wanted a pillow against her back whenever she would sit up, so you had to line all of her five pillows up just to give her a little support. And it was a matter of recognizing that it's okay to laugh at the situations you're in, because sometimes you're in some little bit absurd situations, and it's just kind of funny. On the bottom, she had just had a procedure, and when you have sedation, sometimes it messes with your memory, and when she just woke up, she was used to being in charge and taking control and wanting to know what her numbers are. It was usually her oxygen saturation, but you know, her heart rate ended up being an issue. So she wakes up from this procedure and she has to say something. We're like, oh, Rebecca, you ready to get in a chair? And she's got something to say. So she gets her dry erase board and she writes down, what is the humidity? And then she writes down in the room, and she underlines that. So I said, I don't know, Beck, it's 60%. She seems okay with that for a second. And she thinks about it. And she turns around to me and she says, how did you know that? I said, I don't know, Rebecca. I just made that up. And she gave me the worst side eye that you could ever imagine. She just, what is wrong with you? Why would you make up the humidity? And I was like, okay. And then she stops and she thinks for a second, she crosses out humidity and she writes blood pressure. So I said, what is the blood pressure in the room? She says, yeah. So I said, your blood pressure is this. And she said, okay, I'll get in the chair. And it was just a matter of having that control, but the fact that she had to control it and she had so many things to say in the meantime, even if she wasn't quite sure what she was saying. And it was okay to laugh about it. She also had some pretty intense dreams. And she would make these faces, and you were just like, and to some extent you think, well, I hope she's not having some horrible dreams. And then you look at all the different faces, and I recognize that, boy, they sure do look like a lot of Robert De Niro faces. And it made me feel better just to envision that Rebecca wasn't having a nightmare. She was taking care of some business in her dream. She was serious. So when she was dreaming, we refer to her as Bobby, because she was tough. Bobby didn't take any guff. And as you could see, she's not taking any guff in this picture. And just having that, you know, having those jokes when she'd wake up, you know, I would show her the picture and be like, so you were being pretty tough last night. And sometimes she would find me funny, and sometimes she wouldn't really find me very entertaining. But it was all a matter of trying to affect the mood as much as you could in a positive way. And really, the concentration that we had at that point was build up, get stronger, let's get strong enough to get a transplant. So I would do physical therapy with her beside the bed. She would do mini squats. And on the left, she's squeezing washcloths. She starts to walk, and it's like you need a respiratory therapist with a ventilator, a physical therapist. I was usually walking behind with a wheelchair. She had her walker, and we would go out and we'd take care of business. And every night I would tell her I was proud of her. And her response in the beginning was, I believe you're proud of me, but I'm not proud of myself. And it's tough to hear. And the challenge was, when she was sedated, she was fully capable of getting up and walking and doing everything, and then she wakes up and she can't do any of that. But the importance was not how she compared to last year, it was how she compared to last week. So I learned when I was trying to make those comparisons to say, you know, last week you walked twice, this week you walked three times. You walked 20 feet further this time. You did three more mini squats. You did this many more exercise sessions. And all of those things I could point to that were distinct improvements over the prior week were important to show her you're making these improvements. You know, and we had to celebrate those victories because there were a lot of setbacks. So when you do have a victory, you want to celebrate that. We also found a really large value in the caregivers and our caregiving team, whether it was the doctors, the nurses, the respiratory therapists, the nurses' aides. And Rebecca's memory was a little spotty. So when she first woke up, she would ask, "What happened to me?" Like, she just woke up in this hospital room, couldn't move, couldn't really remember. And I would start to explain the story. Well, you went into the hospital for a tune-up, and then this happened and that happened. And then she would ask, okay, what date did I go into the hospital? What date did they bring me down to the ICU? What time did they bring me down to the ICU? Who was there? And then every single time she would tell me, there was a lady, I think she was a respiratory therapist. She said, "You don't have to work this hard." And she was so nice. And she told me this every time. We had this conversation daily. And she told me this like every time for the first like 2 weeks. And it made me feel that, wow, in her weakest moments, she had somebody that really cared for her, that was really kind to her. And that meant a lot to me. It meant she was in the right place. Then fast forward, this is her birthday. She turned 38 here. This is June. By this point, she had come up to Pittsburgh to get her transplant. And it was her birthday, and we walked in, and there was a sign on the wall that her nurse put up there and wrote out in marker, "Happy birthday, Rebecca." It was kind of minor, but it also meant this nurse that had all these different things to do took the time to write out this happy birthday banner, put it on the wall, and there it is beside Rebecca by the time, even before I got in the morning. And that was a huge boost for me, and it was a huge confirmation that, again, she was in the right place. And I had a lot of people in my corner. When I first announced that Rebecca was in the hospital, one of my friends from Wisconsin drove down 7 hours with his wife, unannounced, just for a chance for a cup of coffee, and then drove back one day. My sister, she worked full-time. She would call me every day on our lunch break. When she had the chance, she would take a day or two and fly out for the weekend. In the upper right, that's her family out on Easter. Her daughter was in the hospital room playing the guitar, playing songs. My nephews, my brother-in-law, my dad, we were all there, and we spent Easter in the hospital room with Rebecca when she clearly couldn't do anything else. On the bottom left, that's Rebecca's sister and her stepdad. Her stepdad obviously called and was concerned about Rebecca, but sometimes he would call and say, "I'm just asking, how are you doing?" My mom, petrified of flying, but flew down by herself several times, which is a way bigger deal than it sounds right now. And my buddy Norm convinced me to do a half marathon. So when Rebecca was napping, I would go out and run laps around the hospital and train for this half marathon. And it was a good time for me to kind of relax and chill out a little bit and get my thoughts together. So having somebody in your corner really does mean a lot. On June 18th, Rebecca got her double lung transplant. The pictures on the left are her lungs. They don't do them justice. They looked horrible. A few days after the transplant, we got to see them. And I was looking at them in shock, and I turned around to catch that expression on Rebecca's face. It was just incredible. We had been through quite a bit. And if you look at the bottom right, that's the ventilator on standby. And I remember taking that picture, and it was so cool because she was on that ventilator for so long and so dependent on it. And then just to see it on standby in a corner, in January, they told us that she probably would only survive a few days. Her diagnosis didn't really change, but she lasted a little bit longer. They told us she probably wouldn't qualify for a lung transplant. We were rejected from the first five transplant hospitals that we contacted. We finally heard back. We did an emergency medical flight up to Pittsburgh. We're through the evaluation. And before Rebecca was even listed, she crashed and was put on a machine called ECMO that continuously pumps your blood through a device, removes the carbon dioxide, adds oxygen, and returns it to the body. And they told us at the time that to probably not expect that she would survive more than 2 weeks. And at that time, she wasn't even listed yet for the transplant. But she did get listed. And part of the reason why she was so high on the list was because she was on ECMO. And she, even though she didn't get her transplant within 2 weeks, she got it in about 2.5 weeks. And it was just in time. And it saved her life. And it was something, again, to reflect on and to be thankful for. I mean, we were in that room with her. She had her noise-canceling headphones on, and she just had her game face on that day. And it was just amazing when the attending came in and just gave us the thumbs up to say, the lungs are good. So, moving forward, there's been a lot that we saw, and as much as I was impressed with the technology and the care that Rebecca received when she was sick and when she was going through all of this, I have even more hope for younger generations because that technology is improving. The technology is getting better, the medication is getting better, the procedures are getting better, everything continues to improve. So it gives me more hope looking forward. And yesterday we got a call after Rebecca's 2-year bronch, and she has no rejection. Things are looking good. In about 2 months, Rebecca is gonna do a local Cycle for Life event where she's gonna ride for 15 miles. And she continues to improve and get stronger. And she's had other setbacks and she's had things that she's dealt with. But right now, she's stronger than she's been in a very long time. And she's doing really well. On the same token, you know, even myself, I left my job to make sure that I could be there and advocate for her. But moving forward, I'm enjoying the opportunity to share what I learned and what I documented in our book. And in one of the final lessons in the book, we don't have control of much, but we can decide how to interpret events, how we want to view the world, and how to respond to the situations we find ourselves in. And that summarized a lot of what I'd learned, where you don't have a lot that's necessarily in your control, but you do have control of yourself, and you can try to control your perception of things. So I'm going to show you a quick video that I put together, then I'll open it up to questions. If you want to learn more about our journey, you can go to cfcornerman.com. I want to thank you for your time and your attention tonight. Thank you.
Stand upright and be strong, and may you stay. Okay, we do have some time for questions. Again, please use the microphone here and allow the volunteers to clean it off between questions.
Your name again, I can't remember.
I'm Ray.
Ray, hi. Yes. Thank you so much. I just want to say you're the kind of partner every parent in this room prays their child finds.
Thank you.
How much physical contact could she have with anyone, even stroking her or, you know, kissing her cheeks or anything?
So when she was in the chemically induced coma, they said pretty much nothing that was going to stir her. So I would pretty much, I could sit there, I could hold her hand, I could hum a little bit or sing a little song or whatever, because I've got this amazing singing voice. No, I don't. But that was about it, because they didn't want you to stir her and have her exert any kind of energy or wake her up. But once she got out of the chemically induced coma, then it was, you were free to kind of help her and do physical therapy together. I mean, I gowned up every day. They told me I didn't really have to, but it was also kind of easier to like point at people and be like, you should have a gown like me. So, you know, it just made it a little bit easier.
Did you bring her to visit us?
I did not bring her to visit you today.
Why not?
Well, previously, Rebecca actually cultured Bisipatia a few years ago. Now, they cleared that up, and she was able to get a transplant. And then more recently, she's been, you know, feeling kind of up and down, which is why she ended up having a bronch. But ultimately, you know, she's still at a point where she's very protective and very much got her mask on a lot. And she was kind of sick from just before Easter until a few weeks ago. So we were really thrilled to find out she had no rejection, but you know, we're still pretty cautious.
Thank you, Ray. You are awesome.
Thank you.
I'm tempted to break the rules and ask two questions. One, how did you move through or sit through the points of despair? Because a lot of your slideshow is beautifully positive, mm-hmm. but the despair, if there was any. Mm-hmm. And secondly, how did you come to this point where you said, oh, I'm going to quit my job in a time of such uncertainty and all the costs associated with transplant? And if that's too personal, you don't have
to. No, that's fine. I actually wrote a whole book, so I talk about everything. I think a lot of it was during a lot of the toughest points, you know, some of it was just trying to focus on, you know, the, you know, like I'd said, you know, be thankful, focusing on the positive times we had together. Sometimes it was just miserable. And, you know, being in a new city, we didn't have any friends or family around. It really did kind of make it tough, but it was, you know, it was something where you go in there for her. And I know I was the one that she had, so I didn't want to let her down. And, as far as leaving my job, I was going into the hospital. Like, I had actually just relocated for a job. I was only there for about 8 months. And I was really excited about the job, but I also didn't qualify for FMLA or anything. But as I sat in the hospital room, when she went into respiratory failure and I started using up my vacation days and personal days, it just occurred to me, like, I can't just leave and go back to work. Like, I gotta be here. I have to be here for the rounds. I really felt like I added value. And because of that, I was like, well, We had always saved money, hoping that, you know, knowing that eventually she'd need a transplant, even though we thought it was further out. So that was really kind of the point where I said, I just can't go back.
Well, that was an amazing story.
Thank you.
I'm really touched by that. And thank you for sharing with us. And we hope we can meet your wife sometime.
Thank you.